Up next, the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. This month, we've been reading Stacy Schiff's biography of Cleopatra. And Ms. Schiff is here to discuss the very modern woman who ruled ancient Egypt and answer your questions about the book. So give us a call at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And later on, science writer Loni Frank explains how mapping her own DNA is giving her insight into the consequences of biological fortune-telling. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're also available as a podcast, and you can find me on Facebook and Twitter.
WNYC support comes from Fauna, offering a selection of captive-raised birds, reptiles, amphibians, and fish. Custom habitat design, in-home grooming calls, aquarium setup and maintenance, and behavior consultation available 265 West 87th Street. More at faunanyc.com. David Henry Huang's Chinglish, the new Broadway comedy about getting lost in translation. Tickets at telecharge.com. Zagat Survey, publisher of the 2012 Zagat New York City Restaurants Guide, with over 2,100 ratings and reviews for top places to eat in NYC. Now available in bookstores and at Zagat.com.
On one fateful night in 1938, thousands of men and women ran from their homes convinced that Martians were invading, all because of a radio play.
But there is one thing we must not overlook. All this took place in 1938, in a less sophisticated yesteryear.
Okay, were we really so unsophisticated back then? Could the War of the Worlds happen again? Here's a hint, yes. We'll find out on the next Radio Lab, where we'll come to you.
Live at the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Tonight at 8 on 93.9 FM.
In this month's installment of the Leonard Lopate Show Book Club, we're discussing Stacy Schiff's biography, Cleopatra, A Life. It's just been published in a paperback edition by Back Bay Books. Cleopatra was powerful, wealthy, politically savvy, and is probably best remembered nowadays for her love affairs with Julius Caesar and Mark Antony. But the Hollywood version, which starred Elizabeth Taylor as the Egyptian queen, has overshadowed the real story of her life. Stacy Schiff, who was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for her biography Vera, Mrs. Vladimir Nabokov, looked back more than 2,000 years to paint a more complete and fair picture of the Egyptian queen. And I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our show. Hi.
Thank you, Leonard. Hi. Great to be here.
Also, we are taking questions from listeners, and we hope that all of you have been reading the book. You can leave a question on our show page at WNYC.org, or you can give us a call at 646-829-3985 to join in the conversation. Cleopatra was the queen of Egypt, but is it true that she wasn't actually Egyptian?
It is true. She descends from one of the generals of Alexander the Great, which makes her Greek. And because her dynasty, for reasons no one has ever entirely been able to explain, practiced brother-sister marriage, she is really entirely Greek. This is a dynasty that intermarries for the 14 generations preceding Cleopatra.
Well, in the Egyptian dynasties, there was also brother-sister marriage. Were they adopting some of the conventions of their predecessors?
They must have been, because there had been no prior use of this practice among the Macedonians. So they must have assumed, they very much try to pass themselves off as Egyptian pharaohs. And they adopt a great deal of the sort of bells and whistles of pharaonic life. So that may have been a piece of it.
How big was the kingdom?
The kingdom is the wealthiest kingdom in the ancient world. And at the height of Cleopatra's power, it really will extend from present-day Libya all around the coast of the Levant, to southern Turkey. So this is bigger than
most of the pharaohs had.
This is as big as any other Ptolemaic ruler had, and the most fertile kingdom, obviously, and the largest kingdom, I think, ever ruled by a woman alone.
Well, how do we have any sense of how she was viewed by the people she ruled?
We have a couple of hints, some of them dispositive, some of them perhaps more arguable. We're told by Plutarch that Cleopatra is the first of her dynasty to speak Egyptian, the language of the people she rules, and that was obviously worth a certain amount popularity-wise.
Which is interesting, because Greek was the lingua franca, wasn't it, of the whole area? We have people in Palestine, or whatever we want to call that area, who spoke mostly Greek.
Put in a more sort of rudimentary fashion, yes, the upper class would have spoken Greek and the lower classes would have spoken whatever the native language was. In this case, it was Demotic Egyptian. And Cleopatra does master that tongue as well. We know that there are no uprisings under Cleopatra's rule, which was unusual for a country as restive and as fractious as Egypt.
And you write that people appeal to her to solve disputes. What kinds of disputes?
You know, that's where I had such a field day, because the kind of things that come to the ruler are everything from, you know, my husband has run off with another woman, and to my daughter won't support me in my old age, to I am a poor lentil seller and I would like you to help alleviate my tax burden. I mean, it's every, when in doubt, write to your sovereign seems to have been the ruling ethos.
There was a lentil seller's complaint about a pumpkin roaster.
Yeah, I think the pumpkin
roaster. How do you find out things like that?
This is like the New York City carts. You know, the pumpkin roaster came and he took my corner at 47th and 6th, and that's my corner and it always has been. What's he doing here? And so you appeal to your sovereign. The answer to your question is that there's some papyri that still exist, that have survived. And, you know, these petitions are very, very clear. Unfortunately, none of the petitions survives from Cleopatra's day.
Kristen, one of our listeners, wrote on our show page, loved the book, wondering whether Ms. Schiff has talked to any of the principal archaeologists looking for vestiges of ancient Alexandria, including vestiges of the queen herself. If so, what do they say about the likelihood of finding significant sites or troves? Also, is there any chance that we'll unearth any contemporary records that will shed more light on her and her life?
Contemporary records, no, because the problem there is not simply that Cleopatra is defeated by the Romans. It is that the humidity of Alexandria has made it almost impossible for any kind of record to survive.
And there's nothing like the Dead Sea Scrolls?
No, so that we know of. I mean, yes, I guess something may show up one day, but there is not a shred of documentation from Cleopatra's day because of the climate. There are two obvious digs. One of them is in the harbor of Alexandria, and that's been going on for some time, and it will be decades in the doing. It's just extraordinary what is under the water. The land has shifted because of seismic activity. A lot has been buried. There are columns. There are sphinxes. There's statuary. It's just a gold mine of material under the harbor and under the city, although that obviously isn't going to be excavated. And then there's an interesting dig about 36 miles west of Alexandria at a place called Tapaceres Magna, where it is theorized that Cleopatra may have been buried, and certainly some notable person of her day indeed is buried. And there's been statuary, there's been pottery, and there have been Cleopatra coins that have come out of the ground.
So answer the question that Will Shorts might ask. Did she kill herself by having herself bitten by an asp?
You know, I, alas, am a naysayer on the asp theory, partly because it would have been difficult, I think, for Cleopatra and her two handmaidens to have done away with themselves with the bite of with one snake. It just seems like one snake, three women, bad ratio. And apparently the kind of death Cleopatra dies, which is a relatively tranquil death, is not the death brought on by snake bite. And as I point out in the book, snakes and women have a rather good and intertwined and powerful history. And there was a lot of reason to pair Cleopatra after her death, more reason to pair her after her death with a snake than there certainly would have been in her life.
Because of the variety and implications?
You know, Adam and Eve, Medea, there are all kinds of women and snakes who basically seem to exist in order to signal moral storm threatening somewhere.
Stacey Schiff's Cleopatra was a national bestseller, number one national bestseller when it was issued in hardcover, called the best book of the year in its review in the New York Times, now available in Back Bay Books paperback edition. And we are inviting your calls at 646-829-3985. We've been receiving questions from listeners. Laura asks, if the women in Cleopatra's time had so many freedoms, and let's talk about that as well, what happened to turn women from a position of strength to second-class citizens?
This was one of the great surprises in researching this book for me. Well before Cleopatra, hundreds of years before Cleopatra, women in Egypt had the rights to enter into their own marriages, divorce, receive alimony payments, buy and run industries, and inherit equally along with their brothers, so that it was estimated that as much as a third of Egypt may have been, in fact, in female hands. There are women physicians, there are women poets, there are women business leaders, it's women priests. It's very interesting.
But you said earlier it was rare to have a woman become queen.
It was rare for a woman to become queen and to rule alone, which is where Cleopatra stands out. There had been previous very powerful Ptolemaic queens named Cleopatra, in fact, but always ruling along with a male consort. For reasons which are rather complicated, Cleopatra winds up alone or with her infant son on the throne. And the short answer to the question as to what happens to that enlightened state of affairs is the Roman Empire. With the defeat of Egypt, In 30 BC and with the rise of Rome, women are put back in their places.
So women didn't have status in Rome.
And it's essentially 2,000 years until they regain those rights that they then enjoyed, yeah.
Do you think that she's been much maligned because she was a powerful woman?
Well, certainly the propaganda begins that way. Even in her own day, she's being maligned and misinterpreted by the Romans who will fight her. And she is essentially in those days drawn as a kind of grotesque, as a kind of grasping, exotic woman whose immediate goal is to conquer Rome and who in doing so manages to reduce Mark Antony to a bundle of cowardly nerves. That is all because Octavia needs to paint her that way. So, yes, she's certainly misinterpreted in her day, and the misinterpretations only continue and become more elaborate over the centuries.
Now, originally, wasn't she supposed to rule with her brother, who was also her husband?
Yes, and the two of them are quickly embroiled in a civil war, and then, oops, he happens to be killed in that civil war rather conveniently. Two siblings remain at that point, a brother and a sister, one of whom Cleopatra will allegedly poison. That would be the brother with whom she is put back on the throne. And the sister is exiled by Caesar to present-day Turkey, and then later, as a favor to Cleopatra, Mark Antony will see to it that that sister is murdered.
Karen of Long Branch writes, "I never realized how long Cleopatra actually reigned. Good for her."
Well, you know, it is good for her at a time when the world is in such turmoil. It's an extraordinarily tumultuous 22 years.
Walter called from Washington Heights. He says that in your introduction, you said that the account in the past, the accounts have been biased since sources are so inaccurate. How did you deal with those difficulties?
Essentially, I tried to avoid anyone, no matter when he was writing, who was clearly writing to please an emperor or for the sake of his poetry. Lucan, for example, is writing closer to Cleopatra in time than almost anyone else. But he's writing kind of sensationalistic, thrilling, salacious stuff, and it's rhyming. He's meaning to write, he's writing fiction. So I essentially discounted him entirely. I would essentially put more weight in anyone like Plutarch, who was writing either from eyewitness accounts or with less of an agenda, or who had seen Egypt in the first place, or who was by culture Greek. The problem here is that most of the sources we have for Cleopatra are not only Romans, but also officials of the Roman Empire.
What about Cicero?
Well, Cicero was my favorite, of course, because Cicero doesn't have a good word to say for anyone, which is the biographer's favorite kind of source. And Cicero is more...
Was he the page six of biographers of the ancient world?
You know, he's just so dyspeptic on every subject, and he's very forthcoming, and he's very easy to read. You can see why he's in a lousy mood. And here this, you know, very rich, very cultivated woman who had a better library than he did rubs him wrong on three counts.
Joan left this comment on our show page. When Cleopatra came to Rome to be with Julius Caesar, she wasn't allowed in the city. Why?
She is allowed in the city, we think. She stays outside. Foreigners were not allowed under normal rules. She lives in Caesar's villa in the hills. Other than that, we know very little about her time in Rome, in fact.
But she was a ruler with great power. I would have thought that any powerful ruler would have been invited into Rome with great pomp.
And certainly her father had paraded through Rome with hundreds and hundreds of escorts in his litter, exactly. We don't know anything about how she gets around the city, but we can be certain that when she did so, it was rather ostentatiously.
We often think about Rome as being the pinnacle of civilization at that time, but you say it was not nearly as civilized as Alexandria.
Well, there again, we have things utterly backwards. I mean, that's one of the great things that you need to disentangle with this story. Alexandria is really the intellectual center, the fashion capital, the seat of learning, the opulent city, the monumental city at the time. And Rome is still a muddy provincial welter of dark, congested streets. There is not yet a monumental Rome as we imagine it today of the Colosseum or the Pantheon. And what will become interesting, of course, is that with Cleopatra's death and with his exposure to her very sophisticated world, things will begin to evolve quite quickly in Rome.
So Rome becomes the imperial Rome we know after the death of Julius Caesar, when the other Caesars, the line of Caesars, begins. with Octavian.
But what's interesting is that two of the reasons for their doing so are actually imports from Egypt. One, culturally and intellectually, I mean, Caesar will bring back from Egypt this idea that there should be a census, that there should be a library, that there should be irrigation channels, that the calendar should be revised. All these are Egyptian imports. And then later the luxury market will come after Cleopatra's death. And suddenly Rome will go sort of Egypto crazy with all kinds of lotuses and hieroglyphics and pyramids throughout the city.
And that happened later during the Napoleonic Age.
It seems to happen whenever anyone encounters Egypt. They contract a case of ostentation, exactly.
How did Cleopatra come to power in the first place?
She's the daughter of the former king, and she, with his death, she and her brother, her next youngest brother, ascend jointly to the throne. There had been an older sister who was the apparent heir, and that sister, clearly an ambitious young woman on her own, when she is a teenager, the father goes to Rome, in fact, and in his absence, that sister usurps the throne. So on his return, he murders her.
Julius Caesar was in Alexandria at the time she ascended to the throne. He was in the palace. Why was he there?
This is a kind of complicated moment where two civil wars intersect. Caesar has been at war with Pompey, who has scurried off to Egypt in search of help. He's been really soundly defeated by Caesar. Pompey lands in Egypt thinking he's going to get help from his sometime ally, the Ptolemies, and he's immediately murdered on the beach. And Caesar has come essentially to run down his rival, and he had thought to knock him off himself. Caesar and Pompey's civil war will intersect with Cleopatra's and her brother's, and when Caesar arrives in Alexandria, it becomes Cleopatra's immediate need to get into the city, to get into the palace, and essentially to convince him that he should ally himself with her and her ragtag army rather than with her brother.
And in the movie, anyway, she used her seductive wiles.
Well, she used some kind of wiles.
How old was she?
She at that point is 21. He's 52. The obvious choice there would have been to back her brother. He had a better army. He had a formidable group of advisors. He had the upper hand with the people. So whatever Cleopatra does in those few moments, first few days with Caesar, must be very convincing because he does end up backing her cause over the brother. And 9 months later, she has not only her kingdom back, but also Julius Caesar's child.
Do you think that this was a love match? I mean, we have the sense that her relationship with Mark Antony was very much about love.
I think we will never get over Elizabeth Taylor is the short answer to your question, Leonard. But no, I mean, I think these were affairs of the state very much more than they were affairs of the heart. I'm not sure how much any queen, much less a Ptolemaic queen, really thought in terms of love affairs, so to speak. I think this was a real power play on her part.
What brought Cleopatra to Rome for the first time? And how was she received there?
We know very little on either of those counts. She is in Rome clearly by Caesar's invitation. She would not have journeyed to Rome without an invitation from him.
Was she there when he was assassinated?
She is there when he's assassinated. And there is an interesting silence on the record, too, because at a moment when he is being taken to task for comporting himself like a monarch and ignoring affairs of state so that he can pursue his own ambitions, no one mentions that he has the Queen of Egypt living across town in his villa with their mutual child. It must have made some impression, certainly.
What about those children? Was it politically advantageous for her to have children with these men?
I don't know that anyone has ever got quite so much mileage out of rearing children as did Cleopatra. Yes, I mean, she manages to cement first this alliance with Caesar by having a son with him. Sons obviously are particularly welcome. And then later, years later, with Mark Antony, she will have twins and another son, all while his wife continues to produce daughter after daughter after daughter. So, yes, she's immensely fortunate, and also her timing always seems to be perfectly opportune.
What happened with those sons?
So the child by Caesar, young Caesarion, as he's called, is murdered shortly after Cleopatra. The old too many Caesars is, you know, more than one Caesar is one too many. And the children by Mark Antony, interestingly, will go back to Rome, will be paraded through the streets in Octavian's triumph over Egypt, so roundly humiliated, and then will be raised by his sister Octavia, who had been Mark Antony's wife, in fact, with her blended family, I guess you would say. They will be raised in comfort and luxury, well-educated, and the daughter will go off to marry another war orphan and set up a King Juba and set up a court in present-day Algeria, which was like a miniature version of her mother's court. The boys disappear from the record at that point.
Kathy left this comment on our show page. What investigations Stacy must have gone through to discover this information? It's very impressive how some women rose to power, and pretty gross how families killed off members like it was nothing. Was the kind of violence we see in Cleopatra's family common at the time?
Well, there I always revert to quoting Plutarch, who deliciously writes, this was the kind of thing that happened in the best of families. Yes, this kind of savagery was pretty much standard operating procedure in the ancient world. You can see it in many later dynasties. You certainly see it among the Medicis, for example. And with the prior Ptolemies, it would have been very clear that if Cleopatra had not murdered her siblings, they would have murdered her. It was really the only true threats to one's hold on the throne were one's blood relatives.
What role did Cleopatra play in the relations between Antony and Octavian?
Well, by the time the two of them are really facing off against each other, Antony and Octavian, Cleopatra is thoroughly allied with Antony. It made sense for two reasons. Antony has essentially set himself up as the general in charge of the eastern part of the empire, what is beginning to be the Roman Empire, which would have made Cleopatra his client queen, so to speak. And secondly, Octavian and Cleopatra are pretty much barred from having any kind of alliance or any kind of intimate relationship by the fact that she has this son by Caesar. Octavian is passing himself off as essentially Caesar's closest relative and son, and here is this other Caesar to complicate the picture. So there's a little bit of an obstacle in the way there.
Michael from South Orange says, some people insist that Cleopatra was a black African, but she's rarely pictured that way. Is there any truth to it?
No, as I say, she is Greek. She would make sense that she were black African since she does rule an African country. However,
But wasn't there even prejudice in Egypt at the time against the people of the South?
Very difficult to say. I mean, it's interesting where there wasn't prejudice in Egypt. I mean, there's no prejudice, for example. There's very little anti-Semitism in the Alexandria of her day. There are many things you can read about Cleopatra. She was not only African, but she was also the grandmother of Jesus Christ. I mean, there are many things you can find out about Cleopatra which turn out oddly not to be true.
How did other leaders of the time, like King Herod of Judea, view her?
Herod was an interesting one for me. She and Herod are at each other's throats because they are rivals for Rome's affection, and very much their fellow client, queen and king. And very much after the same thing, which is to say the favor of Mark Antony.
But Cleopatra had a much bigger territory to offer.
Much bigger territory, much richer territory. Herod has this parched, stony sliver of a kingdom. And moreover, and worse for him, Cleopatra seems always to get the better of him. So there's a great deal of animosity on his part. Herod was useful to me because he's a perfect counterexample for how to deal with the Romans to Cleopatra. And ultimately, of course, he ends up doing beautifully where she is defeated by them.
Rick from Riverdale says, I wonder what Stacy thought of Mark Antony's wife, Fulvia. It appeared that she was an interesting character.
I thought all of the Roman women were interesting characters because, in a way, they seem to be very much Cleopatra's equals. They're uncommonly well-educated women. Fulvia, an even more ambitious woman than the others, very much loyal to their husbands, and yet don't really have a chance because there's no room in the Roman social structure to accommodate a woman of learning or of ambition. So where Cleopatra is able to succeed, these women are constantly thwarted. Fulvia obviously would have been a full match for Cleopatra and does her best, in fact, to attempt to help her husband. Ultimately, Mark Antony ends up undermining him.
And in the case of Cleopatra, her end is connected to the defeat of Antony?
Well, the two of them are defeated together. Antony will commit suicide thinking that Cleopatra has already died. It's unclear whether he gets that word erroneously or whether it's in fact sent to manipulate him in some way. What a Roman commander was meant to do at that moment was in fact to take his own life. So he certainly does what's expected of him. And Cleopatra will follow suit a week or two later.
Now, what attracted you to her as a subject? This is a far cry from Vera, Mrs. Vladimir Nabokov.
You don't think Cleopatra and Ben Franklin have a lot in common, Leonard? There are a couple of things.
They both like to go fly kites, didn't they?
They both like to strategize. She's an outlier in history. It's odd to have a woman with this much power. It's an interestingly mangled story. I can't get over how far the truth is from what we all accept to be true. And it's a world in transition. I mean, I was looking at a hinge point in history. This is a moment where the Hellenistic world is about to end. 30 years after Cleopatra's death, Christ will be born. Egypt's autonomy will be lost until the 20th century. The Roman Empire is about to take off. It's really one of those moments where everything is in transition, and she, in fact, influences it to a great degree.
Was she ultimately a savvier politician than Mark Antony?
I think one would say yes, but I was very aware as I was working on this that that Antony's story, too, comes to us from the men who defeated him. And so this image we have of the bluff, dissipated, fun-loving Mark Antony may be a bit mangled as well.
Well, Cleopatra is condemned for being too strong and masculine, also condemned for being too frail and feminine at other times. Was she held to a different standard than other leaders of the time?
I think, as we know from modern politics, anything that you can say against a ruling politician is always of interest. So any way that the Romans could take her down, they managed to do so, certainly.
Cleopatra, A Life, has been the subject of this month's Leonard Lopate Show Book Club. My great thanks to Stacey Schiff for coming by to talk about it. And we will be announcing our next book club pick in the next hour of our show. So keep listening for that as well. Stacey, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you for having me, Leonard.